My name is Michelle O'Woon, and I'm carrying out this interview on behalf of the Wellcome Trust for the One Another Project. The date is the 10th of October 2009. It's now 3:24 a.m. Could you tell me your name, your age, and where you're from, please?
Daphne Ingham, 56, Sheffield.
When did you come down from Sheffield?
Yesterday. It is yesterday, yesterday afternoon. Yeah. And that was fairly usual because I come down from Sheffield a lot for work, but not on a Friday afternoon. And yeah, good trip. Cheap first class ticket, 30 something quid. I'm watching this woman's face. I know how to play the train fares.
What do you do for a living?
My job title is Director of Strategic Initiatives. I work for Richmond Fellowship, which is a national mental health organisation. I've been working for the same organisation for a long time, but this is quite a new job in the last 18 months. And I do really what it says on the tin. We've got to work out what we're going to be doing for the next few years, what's going on out there. We spend most of our time doing what we do now. And it's about just figuring out what the hell's going on and where it all fits with what we're trying to do and what, you know, what we can direct ourselves at. And maybe partnerships we can get into, and things that are going on that it'd be really good to get in front of, get ahead of in mental health.
Yeah. Can you expand on that?
Yeah, I mean, projects I'm working on at the moment are, I've done a big piece of work which I've now kind of handed on to somebody, a bit more about personalisation, which is about how there's a big policy shift, which is actually supported by all parties, to in social care particularly, to try and get it so that when people need care and support, they design their own packages, because often they know what is going to help them best. And what tends to happen with organisations doing it for them is that you get something that first, you know, that's here it is, take it or leave it, this is what you get. Or maybe, you know, there's a choice of that, but most of the time it's kind of, right, there's this available, this is best for you, go on, off you go and do it. Whereas with people who need sort of social support, often, if they say, well, actually, I know that instead of going to some blooming respite care centre, I could pay a couple of people to look, you know, to look after me when my mum goes on holiday, or I could pay for my, you know, to do something that I know will help me. As often as not, it's less money and more benefit. So there's a kind of big push to get that going, but it's a big change from what's happening now. So an organisation like us needs to think about how that would work, because we work on government contracts basically, and those are about providing services to a specification that's been written, often with, you know, a lot of careful thought about what's needed, and then it's kind of paid for 3 years or whatever. Whereas this is about selling our services to individuals who are in need of them through a process that is quite complicated. So I did a whole project of mapping out what's happening up and down the country and working out what we could be doing about it.
How does the individual become aware of the Richmond Fellowship?
Well, that's an interesting one, because up to now it's usually been because of a third party, you know, like social services or health or somebody helping them has put them onto it and has referred them through the mental health system. That's been the pattern for about the last 20 years. And for us to be kind of explaining our services directly to people without those intermediaries being so important is a new thing for us. But we're kind of very well placed to do that, because we're a voluntary sector. We are very focused on individuals anyway. We're focused on a particular issue, and we've always worked with people on a kind of one-to-one basis. So it's not that huge a shift, but there's an awful lot of mechanics involved and quite a lot of thinking, quite a lot of change of attitude, you know, particularly from the point of view of those of us who are involved in managing things, that, you know, who you want to target with your efforts, you know, because there's been a lot of people who are kind of commissioning services and making these contracts happen who have been very important to us, and they're becoming important to us in different ways, and the people who receive the services are becoming the customers gradually. It's a gradual process, and the jury's out about whether it'll work well, whether the outcomes will happen. Nobody knows, because it's like one great big experiment. There's been some very, very quick wins. Very good things have happened in the first few years, but what will happen is that the tougher scenarios, the more tricky scenarios, will work through. Solutions will need to be found to a lot of questions that nobody knows the answer to yet. Fascinating. So I got really, really gripped into that. Then I'm working now on a project about higher levels of care, people who are stepping down from secure units or have been very entrenched in a system or really need, you know, kind of not just 24-hour presence of staff, but, you know, all sorts of inputs. And where is something we've been doing one way or another for 50 years, you know, we're actually, as an organisation, I think probably quite brave about that. You know, we're not fazed by it, but it takes a lot of figuring out to get that right, and there are huge risks involved. Not so much the risks of, you know, kind of incidents and so on. It's more the risks that we kind of get people into services and then just kind of hold them. It's pointless in a way. You know, it's about recovery. It's about how you can help people rather than almost holding them back. How you can test yourself and make sure you're doing that. So I'm going around talking to people, visiting services, trying to, as almost as an outsider, because I'm not a practitioner, but as an insider, because I'm inside the organisation, I know a hell of a lot about it, to try and tease out some of the really, really good stuff that's going on and where that can be taken to make it even better and how it can be spread. So that's about sort of high levels of care, and I've got other projects that are kind of similar nature, really. I'll probably be starting to look at a bit more closely at welfare reform and things like that. We're very involved with employment jobs. I could talk about this forever.
Are you based in Sheffield, or is it a UK-wide organisation?
It's an England-wide organisation. I live in Sheffield, I work at home a bit, I travel about, I'm in London a couple of times a week. The head office is in London, but the actual services are about half and half, north and south, with not an awful lot in the Midlands. So about half the organisation is spread over the north, northwest, northeast Yorkshire, and the other half is London, home counties, East Anglia, along the south coast, and a little bit in westwards into Wiltshire and so on. So for the people who are kind of central, you know, we communicate a lot with each other anyway, and we move around. So it's really a privilege, actually, to work in a national organisation. But, of course, being in the centre of it, I tend to spend more time in London than anywhere else at the moment. The events that I go to and people I meet quite often in London.
How do you feel about that? Are you happy spending time here or not?
I've been doing it for about 12 years in one shape or form. Previous to this job, I was Director of Development for the organisation. And personally, I work it. I have a rule and that I stick to no more than 2 nights away in any 1 week for work purposes. I can always do a day trip. So I know where I live and I know where my family are. I don't have that thing about, you know, never quite sure where my roots are. No, that's pretty sure. I'm a northerner. But I love London. I love London. I was a student in London. I get the best of all worlds, really, at the moment. Swim in the Serpentine once a week.
Tell me more about, we were talking about swimming before we started this interview. Can you tell me more about that?
Well, when I was coming up to 40, I mean, I hated sport, you know. I'd do anything to get out of it at school. Never into anything like that. But it was around the time when, I mean, my daughter was quite young and one of my closest friends and I were talking on the phone one day like you do. She'd got two young children, I got one. And Jane Fonda had just been interviewed on the telly by Clive James. We'd both seen it, you know, and she was sat there with all her Lycra on, you know, looking like $1 million and saying, you know, women have rediscovered our own athleticism. We better do something, you know. So we decided, we made a bit of a pact, we'd do two things together, you know. We'd both go to Keep Fit and we'd both go swimming. So we did that for a few months, and Keep Fit didn't really suit me, the swimming didn't 100% suit her, but she carried on with the Keep Fit and I carried on with the swimming. And I just got a bit hooked on it. It took me a year. I've never been in a club or anything. I mean, I could always, you know, get across the pool. But I just thought, oh, it's good. You know, I just quite liked it. And I got a few hints about wearing goggles and breathing and things like that from somebody at work who was a swimmer. And by the end of a year, I think I'd done 10 lengths of crawl, which was amazing. I've never done crawl in my life. And then they opened a load of new pools in Sheffield for the World Student Games. It was as if they could have been built for me. They don't even use chlorine in the water. Olympic pool. Heavenly. So I just carried on with the lane swimming. And when I was 40, I did the swimathon, 3 miles in a pool. And that was, I did 30 lengths, what did I do? 30 lengths crawl and 10 breaststroke for the, you know, 200 lengths or whatever it was I was doing. And so I just carried on. And I had I've got another personal rule. I have personal rules. I've got to swim twice a week, about a mile each time. One at the weekend and one between Monday and Friday. If that doesn't happen, the rest of my life's got to change, not the swimming. And so I just carried on lane swimming. Did another swimathon 10 years later for my 50th, which was a roaring success, you know. A lot of things around that. I did it faster time than the previous one. And then a few months after that, I saw this thing in the paper about swimming holidays. And I just, bloody hell, I'm going to do that. You know, I was just really, I was like, my heart was pounding for the next 2 days till I could book the time off. And later that year, I went to Greece and did an island hopping holiday in October. And yeah, it was a life-changing thing, you know. Suddenly I discovered there was this open water swimming, you know. And these holidays, the company. I mean, I've got one of their hats, so I'll be putting it on the plinth. It's just this bloke. It's quite well known in circles. They don't advertise because now nearly all the holidays are completely taken up by repeat customers. It's just like a lifeblood thing. It's wonderful. A bunch of you, a boat, a couple of really experienced guides, one of whom's probably swum the channel. Boat pilot who knows the waters like the back of their hand, and every day you swim, you do a couple of big swims, they provide the lunch. You actually don't have to make many decisions except to, you know, to just swim.
Which islands did you go to?
Well, it's all around, it's the Cyclades. I've actually done it twice because 3 years later I went to the end of year party and I won the top prize, which was a hot day. I've done Paros to Naxos. I've also, some of the big swims I've done, but little hops as well, and coastal swims. And in, you know, there are shorter and longer hops. The big spectacular ones are Paros to Naxos, Gozo, Malta I've done. In British ones I've done Lake District, and I got into lake swimming through just people I met through the holidays. And so I've done Coniston. I got challenged to do that and I did that, and then I had to do it again the next year because my boat crew wanted to do the better boat. So that was 2006 and 2007. So this is all in my 50s. And of course you go to these events, the BDLSA, British Long Distance Swimming Association, there are people in the 70s, you know, still going, you know, miles and miles, and really fantastic fast swimmers at the front, you know. I mean, it takes me a long time. I'm not that fast. I did Coniston in kind of 4 hours. Not allowed wetsuits, no, BDLSA rules. But the front swimmers do it in, you know, under 2 hours, and they just sprint the whole distance. There's some fantastic swimmers who are practically Olympic standard. And at the end, everybody gets a certificate, everybody with their time on it. It's so inclusive. This year, for the first time, they ran a Coniston relay up the lake and down the lake. Three members, run 2-3, 1-2-3. So it's 1.75 miles each, twice. And a friend of mine got a team together, and I was reserve, and I had to be brought in because somebody wasn't well. I really slowed the team down. We were 13th out of 13. Team name, Prophetic. I can't believe we're not better, was the name of our team. We had a fantastic day. The whole boat crewing thing as well. Our boat crew were just a couple of amazing people I know from Sheffield with a funny little boat. And my partner did a bit of rowing, and it's just hilarious. I mean, the other stand-in person had to stand in because two people couldn't make it out of the three. She'd never been in open water before. She could swim 3 miles, but only in a pool. She was amazing. She just appeared from London. Nobody knew her. She was a workmate. The guy had to drop out. And she just did it.
Is it a much tougher challenge to swim in open water than it is in the pool?
And you can't see where you're going. You have to figure out a way of sighting. Which I think was Camilla. She would have been much faster if she hadn't had to stop and do a stroke or breaststroke to look up. And there's a way of sighting when you're doing the front crawl. But she hadn't had the chance to even try that, let alone practice it. And yeah, it's very different. The distance is always imprecise because there's currents and weather conditions and navigation. You know, it's not straight, you know, measured distances. There's safety, you know. And of course, most people, quite rightly, wouldn't just swim out to the middle of nowhere. Some people would. I know people who would do that, but it's I wouldn't. You need, you know, a boat, and you need to be sure you know what you're doing. There's the cold, which is quite an art to deal with.
How
you know.
Combat
that? Well, I'm quite good at it. I did the Corrie of Wrekin Strait last year. In it was about 13 degrees. Three of us did it with no wetsuits. And that was about 13 degrees, and it took, but the longest swim we did on that holiday was actually 2K, which took us about an hour. We didn't get hypothermia, we were quite cold when we got out. You have to get your clothes on quick before you lose your competence. I had to get help with the zip of my trousers. But that you can see how excited I get about that. But I'm really quite excited about mental health as well. But that's what I'm, it's just so good that it's World Mental Health Day. And of course there's huge connections, aren't there, between the two, physical and mental health. Those connections are being made a lot better now than they used to be. If I hadn't got that personal rule, I would probably some evenings think, you know, particularly it's got to a Friday and I haven't had a swim, I think, oh, sod it, I'll watch Have I Got News For You, you know. So I think, oh, I haven't had a swim, so I go to the pool, which is open till 10, swim 9 till 10. Often you might be feeling tired, you might be feeling, oh, you know, been a big week. You make yourself go, you never regret it. You come out feeling less tired. You don't come out feeling hungry. I think that's a complete myth. I mean, I always eat before I swim anyway because I've got diabetes. So I have to make sure my blood sugar's all right. And you just come out feeling good. Good.
When did you first become involved with mental health?
My job that I started in 1990, I worked in housing. For a long time, development, and I got involved in a little tiny bit in the job I was in. It was a very local job in Sheffield in supported housing, and then 1990 I moved jobs to another housing association that did a lot of supported housing work, and they were doing a lot of work around the real back end of the hospital closures, the hospital reprovision. I didn't know anything about mental health, but the first thing I had to do, one of the first things I did was it was about the practical side behind moving the last 25 people out of Middlewood Hospital in Sheffield. I'd never even been there. I'd lived 2 miles away, you know, for all these years. And I start going to meetings there, and the last people are moving out. And then I was in that job for 3 years, and I was doing a lot of things around a lot of vulnerable client groups, but mental health was very prominent in it, and I met a lot of people who were involved in it through actually, you know, needing the services or running them or whatever, and I got quite hooked on it. It's amazing stuff goes on. There's a lot of laughs in it. It's not all, you know, doom and gloom. There's a lot of successes in it, and then I moved to full-time work. I took this job in Richmond Fellowship, and I've been working in this organisation since 93, so I've got a lot of experience in it now.
Why did you want to take part in this project?
Well, a whole bunch of us signed up for it at work. We thought, hey, we're rebranding, you know. We've got a very inspirational PR person who's actually going to be out there today. It was her idea. Come on, let's all sign up for this. And we went, yes. And our chief exec, who's also showing up, said, oh, yeah, you know, she put a name down, put something around the organisation. If you want to put your name down, put your name down. We'll support you. You know, if it comes up, let's just use it and put a name out. Because we're not heard of. We don't have a public profile to speak of. We have a profile in certain, you know, arenas, you know, health and social care. And this year we've done a real exercise saying, what should our profile be? Talk to people. And everybody says, come on, you know, get your name up there. This is ridiculous. You know, our name wasn't known. It's a funny old name. But it's a worthwhile name. A lot of people know it. It's as good as any name. And even our logo was just the initials and the strap line. And oh, come on, get the name out there. So you can see why I mean, I shall be going doing a pull-up, but the name will be there, and I'll talk a bit about the organisation, but I'll talk about other things as well. And so we're doing all sorts of things to get our name out there at the moment. Just little things, you know, not huge things, but things. And the whole thing about shouting out, you know, for mental health is really very important. It's countering all the, you know, misinformation that's out there. Yeah. So actually, I think quite a lot of people did put the name down, and one person was on the plane, the 28th of August, Rebecca Lord, who works for us, and actually she'd got a place before the thing came round. She said, "Oh yeah, yeah, I'll mention the organisation." So we came down, and she did this brilliant thing. She's kind of a budding artist. She's also an employment advisor. She's also got a diagnosis of bipolar. She didn't mind telling anybody, and. She had this brilliant idea, and I was in cahoots with her because I was kind of the connection to organise the support. We paid for the helium. We turned up. And she got her hopes and dreams secret and wrote them down in little effigies. And every now and again, she let one up into the sky. And she called it her aerostatic army. And it's kind of a fantasy idea that you can make things happen like that, you know, kind of cosmic ordering. Okay, you know, it's a fantasy, but there's nothing cosmic about writing down your hopes and dreams and thinking about them. And the value of that is kind of huge in mental health. And that's one of the things we encourage people to do. You know, where would you like to be? You know, well, let's get some ideas here. You know, just, even if it's just plucking something out of the air. And then she had a thing, Rebecca, which I thought was really interesting, about looking up. She'd looked up some things, and she said, apparently, if you look up, it's likely to make you happier, you know, than looking down. There's studies been done. Studies been done on everything. And so, you know, it was a lovely thing, that, and it was a sunny morning. A few of us came down. And so, oh, well, you know, and I had my name down, but I couldn't believe it when it came up, World Mental Health Day.
Are you looking forward to it?
Yeah. I'm really excited, partly because people have told me. I mean, Rebecca, she said, I want to do it again. I didn't want to come down.
Is there anything else you'd like to say before you go up on
the I think, as you say, this is a free-form thing that people might read in posterity and think, why on earth did people do that? I think I've got that across. I think people will see, you know. And I don't mind standing up and doing things, you know. I'm not shy about that. I don't mind going and talking to strangers in the street and things like that.
And you are wearing your swimsuit.
It's quite modest, really, but it comes off. I've got tights on there because it might be a bit cold. But silly, that's just because I'm nesh, you know. I've got a t-shirt to put on after, but that doesn't come off until I've done quite a bit of other stuff. I wanted to look smart. I mean, charity t-shirts are great, and I've actually got one which I probably will put on, but. I want to say to people, mental health is about serious things, and it is about being smart, and it is about being, we're having a nice jacket and being proud and being professional almost, you know, and being, you know, having expectations. And when people come to a mental health facility, you don't always want them to feel, you know, that it's a load of settees and cups of coffee. Sometimes you want an office and something that's about the real, you know, tough world out there. You know, you don't want to be protected from it all and in a ghetto of mental health all your life. So there's a subliminal message there as well. Look smart, you know, and all that. Be businesslike. Yeah.
Thank you very much indeed.